Welcome to Current Affairs. My name is Nathan Robinson. I am the editor-in-chief of Current Affairs magazine. And I am here today. I am joined by the legendary historian, Harvey J. Kay. He is professor of democracy and justice studies at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. And he is the author of a number of books, including Thomas Paine and the Promise of America, The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great, including the book Why Do Ruling Classes Fear History, and including the book Take Hold of Our History, Make America Radical Again. And Take Hold of Our History, Make America Radical Again has a blurb from the legendary TV producer Norman Lear, creator of All in the Family, who says, no one has ever loved a nation more or spanked it harder for straying from its premise than Harvey K. And the reason I love that quote is that it does really capture one of the central themes that runs through all of your work, all of these different books that I've cited that you've put out over the years, which have a common underpinning, which is trying to dig out and redeem what is best and most noble about American history, while, as he says, spanking the country hard for its various transgressions. So, Professor Kay, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Oh, thank you.
The latest book that you have put out is a kind of recapitulation, Take Hold of Our History. That title really, really captures what sort of comes up in the Thomas Paine book, in the Four Freedoms book. You have that wonderful question, you know, why do ruling classes fear history? It seems like as a historian, this is how I'm going to characterize you, and then you can correct me if it's an unfair characterization. As a historian, it seems to me that you are exasperated by the way that reactionaries seize the story of American history and tell a nationalist myth, right? They tell a story about the country. In Take Hold of Our History, you have this fascinating chapter about Newt Gingrich, who you almost admire in a certain way, because Newt Gingrich has a PhD in history, and you talk about the way that Newt Gingrich, you know, weaves this story about the role of religion in American life and how skillfully he does that. And it seems to me like common to your work is a frustration that we on the left, who have so many things that we can be proud of in American history, sort of lose sight of all of these great people who came before us and this wonderful story that we have to tell. And sometimes we lapse into a cynicism about American history, and we see it as a parade of exploitation and imperialism, which in many ways it is, but we also have this incredible democratic legacy and tradition that we can, as you say, take hold of. Is that fair?
It is, but let me just preface a little bit. I'm old enough to have a past even before Why Do Ruling Classes Fear History, which was 1994, I think, published. Just for the record, my childhood hero was Thomas Paine, so we'll set that out as a marker. But it's also the case that almost all of my studies, bachelor's, master's, and PhD, were in Latin American studies. And I worked on landlord-peasant relations and things like that. And because of a whole long story that would take us a whole night to discuss, I ended up shifting radically to work on the British Marxist historians. And I published a first book, The British Marxist Historians, which, by the way, is coming out again this spring in a third edition. But it was in the British Marxist historians' work that I really kind of discovered a sense of how to write history. It really did enable me to think about history in a more dialectical and more, if you like, class struggle kind of way. And in that sense, not to assume that the role of the left is simply to debunk, but actually to ask ourselves, why, in our case, Americans, why do our fellow citizens evidently feel so unsettled and so anxious and increasingly so angry about the state of America? I don't think we can answer that question if we don't consider the degree to which, it's going to sound a little culturalist, I admit, but we carry a kind of deep cultural memory of the struggles that went into making not only an American republic, but all the more the struggles that in every generation have arisen to challenge the powers that be and make demands for the people based on the original promise that was inscribed in American history by Thomas Paine and then officially pronounced in the Declaration of Independence and the preamble to the Constitution. I mean, I wrote a book about Thatcher and Reagan, the powers of the past, in which I actually detail the way in which not only Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan grabbed hold of and made use of and abused British and American history to create a narrative that would obscure the struggles that I thought were important. And then in the course of the 90s, in some ways pushed by a few of the British Marxist historians themselves saying, why don't you write American history? Well, I ended up writing about Paine. And what I discovered was that I was wrong, that historians and biographers were wrong about Paine's place in American history, that he had been so fundamental to the revolution, but that his memory had been suppressed for generations. And yet what I discovered, in some ways serendipitously, in a library, spending all day in it, is that in every single generation, every struggle that emerged, whether it was the free thinkers, the working men's parties, the abolitionists, the suffragists, the populists, the progressives, the socialists, I mean, right down the line, labor unionists and others, when they asserted themselves in a radical fashion, they often reached back to the American Revolution and laid claim to Paine himself and Paine's arguments to validate their claims, not only on the past, but their claims on the future. And I thought, where are we on the left that we've become so good at debunking and critiquing? And my generation wrote a lot of history from the bottom up, but why is it that the left, whether we're talking, in quotes, liberals, progressives, or socialists, why is it that those works have not found their way into the discourse of American politics through those who claim to be progressives? And so my role, I came to believe, was to, in some ways, sort of, Bill Moyers once said, you're gonna make the left as angry as you do the right with this kind of stuff. And I said, yeah, I mean, we ought to be angry. As a friend of mine said, why is it that the left refuses to lay claim to the heroes who are rightly theirs? Why do they feel it necessary to take down the folks who, look, nobody's a saint, okay? People, I mean, we could lay out the names of people who were treated as heroes who weren't by no means saints and should be heroes perhaps on the left. But the left has this instinctive look at history where they want to smack and debunk and deconstruct. And I'm not saying everyone, it's just that, so I asked myself the question, how can this be? And here's what I think it is. In the wake of the 60s, into the 70s and the 80s, the left was in such retreat that the instinctive response on a lot of people's parts was to point fingers at the kinds of things that had been so long suppressed from the school books, okay? The slavery, the marginalization of women, the suppression of labor movements, all of the things that we know about, and by the way, are in the history books today. But it's the case that the movements on the left will hold, yeah, call it political correctness in a way. God forbid somebody should talk favorably about Lincoln. Someone's going to say, but didn't you know that Lincoln did such and such? Or about FDR, didn't you know that such and such? Well, I actually do think that liberal democratic politicians, especially the neoliberal, but liberal democratic politicians ran and continue to run from history. I don't think it's just an ignorance. I think they just literally run from history because they're afraid that Black Lives Matter or the socialist left or the women's movement will take them down. And as a consequence, they turn their backs on a history that also fails to consider the struggles from the bottom up, the struggles of slaves, the struggles of women, the struggles of workers. I can go right through American history. So my point was that we have to speak, and I'm saying this in a political way, we have to speak to the anxieties of our fellow citizens and let the history, in essence, remind them of who they are. We have to master the narrative far more effectively than we've done probably since FDR. By the way, I'll give you a footnote to that. Back in 1986, we were living over in England, and there was an election year, 87, that summer. Labor got walloped by the Tories, absolutely walloped. Thatcher just triumphed. And I just thought to myself, well, when did we hear Labor remind the Brits themselves of their own grand story of struggles, whether going back to the from the peasant rising to the labor movement? I wrote a piece for The Guardian. I wrote it so effectively that the editor titled it Our Island Story Retold. And it clearly wasn't my island, but effectively, but it was the case. Yeah. And I think that made me all the more determined to ask the similar kinds of questions here in the States. And I'm sorry I went on so long, but you know.
No, that's a good place to start, because you reminded me when talking about British labor in that period. I was recently reading G.A. Cohen, Jerry Cohen's a piece that he was writing about in the I think 1990s about why labor needed to get back to first principles. And he was looking at some of the arguments that they'd been making, the rhetoric they'd been using. And what he said was, he was pointing out something that recently sort of how the Tories were actually raising taxes rather than cutting taxes. And he said, well, you know, what are you doing with this kind of rhetoric? Well, you're pointing out the hypocrisy of the other side. You're almost reinforcing the idea that raising taxes is a bad thing, and you're establishing yourself, you know, in the opposition to the hypocrisy of the other side. But what they are doing is weaving a narrative, a story, something inspiring. And he said, you know, and this is why he said we need to get back to our socialist principles. Yeah. We have something that we can be proud of. We have good ideas. We have an inheritance. We have a tradition. We have, you know, there's so much that we shouldn't give up in favor of pure critique, because pure critique inspires nobody. And so.
Right. Yes. Well, you know, I was thinking about this whole idea of critique. This goes back, probably during the 80s, given the Reagan years. And I remembered somebody saying that the left always falls back on critique when it's out of power, but it never really seeks to remind Americans of a story that would enable them to realize that the way things are is not the way they have to be. You know, that you can critique and just satisfy people's anxieties by letting them, you know, bellyache about things. And then I was thinking just today, Nathan, before we went on, I was thinking about this project of mine that I've been pursuing all these years. And I was remembering that in the 1920s, the term debunk became part of the political discourse. And there was it was a popular historical writer who went after the idea that George Washington was the father of our country. And he made the case that it was really Thomas Paine. Now, all well and good, but the point is, it's in the 20s when the left really was marginalized and labor unions had really been pushed aside after World War I. And you had the Red Scare, and then you had the immigration quotas. And the left barely existed in the 20s. Yeah, I know there was the new Communist Party. The numbers were hardly worth talking about. The socialists were significant, but would never be as significant as they had been when Eugene Debs was alive. And I was thinking, isn't it interesting? So in the 20s, debunking became the thing for the left, okay? And then in the 70s through the 80s, we fell back on that again. And the tragedy is that we've been falling back on it for the last 45 years. And so I'm on behalf of my fellow left historians from whose generation we call the 60s and 70s, there's a hell of a lot of good history that ought to be articulated into a form that politicians on the left, you know, for example, that AOC and Bernie, folks of that sort, will grab hold of that history. And let me just say, and we can come back to this, I don't want to keep talking straight, is that as much as I love Bernie and I voted for him, and even back in the 80s, I wondered if I'd ever get to vote for a guy like Bernie Sanders. And then, of course, he's on the ballot for the Democratic nomination in 2015-16. But I have a critique of Bernie in those terms, okay? In 2015, Bernie Sanders was clearly the rising star of, he's not a Democrat with a capital D, but the Democratic Party. And the Clintonites clearly were worried. However effective the machine that they had created might be, they were worried. And Bernie himself, in the fall, I think it was November of 2015, he went to Georgetown University to give a speech to explain democratic socialism. Now, look, there's a role for you writing about democratic socialism and Bhaskar and all the rest of us. But if a politician has to go before the American people to explain what democratic socialism is, we're in trouble. Okay? And I mean, what I mean by that is if you're going to have to spend part of your time explaining yourself, you're just not going to win the final election. But more important than that, so he spoke and he did an incredibly amazing and brilliant thing. He linked himself to the tradition of FDR, Martin Luther King, and the better angels of LBJ's nature, okay, from, okay, that kind of thing.
Right.
Now, that was marvelous. What he did is he grabbed hold of the FDR that most Americans actually deep down admire, even if they couldn't tell you the story of FDR, okay? And I thought, this is it. This will be the turning point. This is where the Clintons will be on the run. And then what did Bernie do? He went out back on the campaign trail and never mentioned FDR in any major fashion again. And Hillary, of course, picked on him because instead of Bernie talking about the New Deal and reviving it, he talked about Scandinavia. And she said, well, we're not Denmark. Yeah, okay. Yeah. And she won that debate. Nobody remembers anything.
Right, because Americans are suspicious of Europe and know nothing about it.
Right, but how many Americans, look, I've been living in the Midwest for 40 years. I can tell you, you're not going to convince any Midwesterner, however much they may have Scandinavian roots, to vote for someone who's going to pitch a foreign country. Now, let me come to 2019. Let me see what you think of this. So now he runs again. Great. And if one looked at his website, one would have said, this is the FDR of the 21st century. I mean, it had everything, the labor question, it had the Economic Bill of Rights, it had all that. But out on the campaign trail, he didn't talk FDR. And in, I think it was probably November of 2019, he decided he's going to explain democratic socialism again. And he did the same thing. He made a really great speech. And then he went back out on the campaign trail and he didn't pick up on it. And I can tell you that... That when the debates began, he should have done what Eugene Debs did, defending himself to the jury in 1918. Debs was convicted of sedition. That was under the Wilson administration during World War I. And what he did in his own defense is he stood before the jury and he actually started to call into the courtroom Thomas Paine, Patrick Henry, came through to Abraham Lincoln. He actually called into the room radical and progressive figures from American history in defense of his own politics and his socialist understandings of the world. Well, Bernie, on that debate stage, every time he spoke, say Medicare for All or anything else, the likes of Buttigieg or Harris or somebody came at him for being ready to bankrupt the United States. What Bernie should have done is he should have called FDR into the room and reminded the Democrats that if they think they're the Democrats with a capital D and that he's the socialist with a capital S, they're missing out on the fact that he stands alongside of the greatest Democratic politician ever.
So the argument here would be then that instead of saying, well, you have all these social democracies over in Europe and they seem to do quite well, you don't look at the present of other places that Americans don't know about. In fact, you can appeal to things that Americans have just forgotten in their own past, where you can say, you know, well, what has actually happened is that the Democratic Party has lost everything that made it valuable and worth voting for at some point, and that there's something that we can be proud of and that has been abandoned and betrayed. I mean, obviously, I really don't like the word patriotism because I just think the connotations are so ugly that I understand that when you say, oh, we want to reclaim patriotism. But I do think like pride in various parts of the American story and American culture is something that I have. Yeah, that seems right. I mean, there's so much that has just been deliberately suppressed. Obviously, and of course, you can speak about the radical Martin Luther King, right? Because Martin Luther King, we have this advantage with Martin Luther King where he's been elevated to sainthood, essentially, where no one can speak ill of Martin Luther King. But what they do is they just make sure that nobody actually listens to anything Martin Luther King said.
Right.
But what that means is that we have one of the American saints that you can't speak ill of endorsing basically the entire Bernie program.
Well, you know, two things I'll remind you of. Do you remember Michael Moore's film, Where to Invade Next, or something
yes,
like that?
Yes, yes, yes.
Well, yeah. Most people seem to have missed the point of that movie. He was not praising the Europeans for their innovations in social policy. The whole point of that movie was to say, every one of these things as a progressive, you know, initiative was rooted actually in the American story.
Mm.
He says it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right. So,
yeah. No, you see what I mean?
Right. Yeah, I remember. So the way this movie goes is that if people aren't familiar with it, Michael Moore basically goes and looks at other countries where he looks at the school lunches in France, and he looks at healthcare in different countries, and he looks at all these things they have and says, you know, the title is like, where we, instead of, you know, we should invade these countries and take their innovations. But then the sort of twist that he puts on it is then he comes back to America and he's like, well, wait a second, actually, you know, all of these things have deep American roots, and we don't have to necessarily look around the world. The answer was within ourselves all along.
We're not going to get anywhere telling people how good it is in Sweden. For example, how many people do you think in America would know who the father of Social Security is? And maybe you don't either.
Who is the father?
Agrarian justice. He begins in Rights of Man, Agrarian Justice. He lays out the.
Well, okay, yes. I want to talk about Thomas Paine because I think let's talk Paine because you're obviously one of the foremost Thomas Paine experts in the country, and you know, and you've written about him extensively. He's in this new book, and one of the arguments that you make in the piece on Thomas Paine in the new book is that we need to read Paine and reclaim Paine, and it is absolutely true that of the founding fathers, Thomas Paine is the least discussed, despite being probably the single most influential, or at least a man without whom I think it's pretty clear the American Revolution would not have happened. People who discover Paine always go through this wonderful revelation where you realize that, you know, the person without whom the country would not exist was, you know, so bitingly critical of religion, such a strong defender of democracy, was anti-slavery, lacked all of the vices that make so many of the other founding fathers such an embarrassment and so difficult to take real true pride in, because for whatever their accomplishments, it's very difficult to celebrate anyone who owned human beings, right? But Thomas Paine is a very different story. And because Thomas Paine is someone you could be proud of and who stood up on principle, there was sort of a deliberate effort to suppress and forget Thomas Paine's contribution.
Yeah, you know, and if Paine were alive and here, he would say, but please understand, what I really did was to show Americans what they were already doing. In 1774 and 1775, Americans had literally risen up and ejected British authority from their government roles, and they had created committees. It was an anarchist dream. It was the colonials literally established committees to govern themselves through the course of 1775. In fact, the irony is the first person to realize what was at stake in all of it wasn't an American. Paine hadn't even arrived in America other than some weeks before this speech was given. Edmund Burke, the most, you know, the father of modern conservatism, went before Parliament to warn his fellow parliamentarians, don't push the Americans any further. They might realize they've already carried out a revolution. And then 9 months after that, he gave that speech in Parliament, Paine releases, he publishes, with the encouragement of Ben Franklin and others, the call for the revolution. But even then, the first call in the pamphlet, Common Sense, is to remind Americans of their that we're instinctively democratic, and not only Americans, that humanity is instinctively sociable and democratic, and that it's the British who've imposed this terrible regime on us, and it's imperative to get rid of kings and literally create a democratic republic. Well, so even with Paine, the brilliance of Paine is what he saw in his fellow citizens to be and held up a mirror to that. And in some ways, you know, to go back to the Bernie thing, Bernie recognized how angry Americans were. And that's why he harped on the billionaires. What Bernie didn't do was remind Americans as to why they might feel that way. Okay, so indeed, he created a miracle, and socialism is back on the agenda in various forms. But he could have, to my mind, created a narrative that other politicians would have either had to embrace or literally switch parties.
And you, by that, you mean, you know, we don't like kings. You know, we're a country founded in opposition to the rule of, and billionaires essentially become monarchs, right? They are unaccountable, right?
Right. Well, even FDR called the likes of the billionaires, you know, the multimillionaires of the 30s, he called them economic royalists.
Yeah. And drawing that connection in people's head between, you know, King George and Jeff Bezos, yeah, can be really quite powerful.
Or Donald Trump and his, you know.
Well, yes, know, right. You know,
a petty king.
Perhaps, man in a golden tower ruling over you. Yeah,
right, exactly.
There are a number of inspiring things about pain. And another one of them is, I mean, as a writer, I've taken a lot of inspiration from him because he is someone who writes. He is a debunker, right? A lot of his work he is kind of first of the great debunkers, because he, you know, in the Age of Reason, he essentially debunks the Bible, and he goes through and points out all the internal contradictions meticulously. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in The Rights of Man, he's debunking Edmund Burke. He's writing this takedown of Edmund Burke. So I've taken a lot of inspiration for that. But the other thing is that he is a small d democratic writer, in that he has sort of faith in the public, in a wide public, to be able to appreciate sophisticated ideas. And one of the incredibly inspiring things about Thomas Paine's writings about common sense is you realize that this is a guy who did not dumb anything down for people and had a great faith in people's ability to understand his argument, and who managed to succeed in getting, you know, really strong, radical political writing to an absolutely massive audience with actual historical effect.
Yeah. You know, first, everyone should realize he was raised in an artisan household, sort of like the upper reaches of the working class, an artisan household. His father was a corset maker, and he himself apprenticed as a corset maker. But it's also the case that he did attend school up until the age of 13. He loved British literature, Shakespeare, Milton, and Bunyan, apparently. And he actually aspired to be a poet, which did not happen, and his poetry is fairly mediocre. But his writing, if you read it patiently, really has a poetic sort of character to it. But it's also, and I really want to get back to this, he really understood how underestimated working people were, because he was one of them. And so he knew how to speak in a way that didn't speak down to people. So the debunking that he carried out, as I said before, in Common Sense, he starts by opening with the question of democracy, and he reveals to his readers, who he knows are going to be predominantly Americans, the degree to which there is what they are doing is already carrying out a revolution for, and he never uses the word, democracy. Okay, he actually he talks about communities meeting under a big oak tree to deliberate and create rules that would govern everyday life. And then he goes on to debunk the British, the revered English Constitution, the role that kings have played. And he uses reason, he uses history, he uses incredible, indeed even vulgar humor to pull them down. And then he comes back to the people. And by the way, along the way, he drops hints that it's not only kings we should be wary of, it's rich people too. Because he says at one point that, you know, the richer are, how's he put it? Timid. They're afraid. And he doesn't mean they're afraid, you know, to make money. What he means is they're afraid to say what needs to be said. We need a revolution.
One of the pieces of advice you have in the book is that we should read Paine, not just respect Paine, but go back and read Paine. Yeah. And I actually picked up. So I was flicking through on this advice, some of Thomas Paine's writings. And it is incredible. You really don't get it until you read it. I am a strong advocate of going back to primary sources because oftentimes there are so many things. People are so much more, historical characters are so much more interesting than in the third person, the description of them. And as I was reading Thomas Paine's writing, you found this when you actually dive into the writings. I found, you know, things about corporations, right? There's anti-corporate stuff where you talk about the problems of corporations. There's this, you mentioned the humor. I was reading The Age of Reason and he quotes some Bible passage, and I'm a big fan of the parenthetical aside, like the snarky parenthetical aside. And then he quotes a Bible passage in the middle of quoting the Bible passage, somewhere where it says, "And the Lord ordered all of them slain." He just puts in a parenthetical, "The Bible is full of murder." I just laughed and laughed because it's such a contemporary, like, it's so funny and it's so snarky and it's so irreverent and it's so fresh. And to hear that voice coming to us from hundreds of years in the past is just an amazing feeling.
You know, his mother, who was an Anglican, made him memorize the Bible. His father was a Quaker. And, you know, the Quakers believed in a sort of an inner light, you know, in essence that he had, and there was this contradiction in the family in terms of religion. And he probably sensed the contradiction. And the more he read the Bible at his mother's command, he basically, I think somewhere he observes, he actually, you know, talks about the fact that this can't be God. He believes in God.
Mm. He's a deity. Oh, yeah.
God would not be this cruel. He rejects that. Okay. And, you know, and you catch that parenthetical statement about the murderousness of the stories in the, you know, that he's read. And that's the same pain as the little boy who was commanded to read the Bible.
He detests the Bible. I mean, what's so interesting about The Age of Reason reading it is he's so scathing about the Bible and organized religion, but he's so, you know, such a strong defender of God. In fact, he says there is a Bible. And the Bible is the natural world. We need to be inspired by the world around us, which is that is what has been actually created or revealed to us by, you know, by God. Basically, he doesn't like the Bible because he finds it that it cheapens our wonder at the natural world, at all of creation around us.
You know, he says, "My religion is to do good," and he says the model for that is the creation itself, that God, this all-powerful being, created the earth and humanity, and that this was this incredibly generous gift, and we should all take that as an example of what we should be to each other. And, you know, and by when I read that, I think I first read Age of Reason when I was 15, and I remember there was this question, well, where is God if God created all of this, and what is he or she doing now, kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But he actually has somewhere in Age of Reason, I believe, an answer, which is probably what the physicists came to believe as well, that, you know, the universe is expanding and maybe the creation is continuing. And I do believe that Paine makes a reference to that. It's just a side that I remember from when I was 15, so...
When you tell me that his mother made him memorize it, that makes sense, because at one point he says something like, "I've not been able to access an actual Bible because I've been writing this while I've been imprisoned," because I believe he wrote. Yeah. Yet he's quoting, you know, chapter and verse from the Bible. And he says, "I'm sorry that I haven't been able to check this in an actual Bible, but I know it's there." Right. And I was like, how did you? Actually, he just said he didn't have access to one. So it puzzled me when I read it, but now I understand it. He just knew it by heart.
One of the things that for generations, British schoolboys had to memorize was poetry. And whenever I would, when I was living in England, when I studied there, when I went back as you know, on sabbatical, we were just living there for a while. And I could not get over that men my age, and more so than women, but men my age really did know poetry. They could recite it without having to look at it. Over dinner, they could bring it up. And I used to think to myself, God, if I could do that, I'd really be effective, you know? And Paine basically learned how to remember these words, his books. Look, I mean, don't people marvel when they discover figures like Marx and others learn more than one language? I mean, it's a damn the television, right? That's all I can say.
It's just a fascinating life, and someone who is worth reclaiming as you know, if there is in that founding generation someone who can be considered pretty heroic, Paine is it. And then, of course, you have the internationalism of Paine, which is another sort of inspiring thing. The fact that not only does he help to set off the American Revolution, but then goes in support of the French Revolution, and you know, and then, of course, is turned upon basically by everyone steadily by being a person of principle, because it's also a story of what happens if you refuse to flatter the powerful. Paine ends up alienating himself from the rest of the founding generation of Americans. Paine ends up alienating himself from the French revolutionaries. Paine ends up alienating himself from British elites, right? You know, he is in the end sort of a man without a country, and then infamously kind of dies in poverty.
To his credit, the one figure of the founders who never turned on Paine was Jefferson.
Mm.
And in fact, in a letter, so I don't remember who wrote it. I don't know if it was an American, a Britisher, or a Frenchman, wrote to Jefferson to ask, who do you believe the greatest writer of the Revolution was? And Jefferson was a renowned writer, but he knew that he wasn't the greatest writer of the Revolution. And he actually said, Paine was that man. It's his words that made it happen. And he gives that credit. And by the way, it's that very same Paine who utterly pissed off the likes of John Adams and those who were destined to become Federalists and, you know, the worst of the elitist bunch.
Which is what you got to do if you're going to be a person of principle. And
if anyone wants to some entertainment at night, get a copy of the letters between Jefferson and Adams. And Jefferson is always careful about what he's going to say. He's always careful. They call him the Sphinx because you never quite know. And Adams writes as if he's on a therapist's couch. He lets everything out, just tell everything. And the words he uses to describe Thomas Paine and his writings are utterly gross. And but, you know, there's Jefferson saying, you know, sort of not responding, and at which pisses Adams off all the more.
A judicious silence. And of course, you cite that quote from Teddy Roosevelt calling Paine the filthy little atheist.
Yes. Yeah. And Paine was neither filthy little nor an atheist. There were times he may well have been so deeply immersed in his work that he probably needed a bath and probably had a few drinks too many. He was not little, but in terms of the times in which he lived, he was 5'9" or 5'10", which was actually rather athletic in those days, they would say. And finally, he was no atheist. He was a deist. But it's Teddy Roosevelt, not Franklin Roosevelt.
It is quite easy to mistake him for an atheist at various points, because if you just took the quotes that he has about the Bible and religion and missed the other half of it, where he's talking about the wonders of God's creation, you really could. I mean, he's just as scathing about organized religion as Richard Dawkins.
No, absolutely. There's no question about that. But he said that one of the reasons he wrote Age of Reason was the fact that the Jacobins, the French revolutionaries who had come to prevail in the course of the French Revolution, were not only shutting down Catholic churches, but persecuting religious believers. And then constructing their own, basically, what was it called? The Church of Reason or Temple of Reason. In other words, his feeling was that it was imperative for him as to defend God. Paine believed he was defending God against those.
And nobody religious believed that Paine was defending God.
Nobody. Absolutely
did not.
Did not
persuade anyone.
No, absolutely not. And it is the case that throughout American history, those who never failed to grab hold of Thomas Paine were, in fact, the atheists through the years. It's a fascinating story, his legacy, because it really did inspire radical ideas and radical politics and labor unionism and socialism and all the rest. And the shame of it is that we spend more of our time on the left going after the founders rather than promoting the founder, you might say. And by the way, Ronald Reagan, who was far more brilliant than anyone on the left ever appreciated, when he was running for president, finally won the nomination to presidency.
Boy. That's a controversial statement to just throw out.
The guy was brilliant, Ronald Reagan. Brilliant. I'm not telling you he was an intellectual, but I'm telling you he was a brilliant politician. Okay.
Right.
Reagan in 1980, running for president once again, on the campaign trail, grabbed hold of the most radical line in modern history, which was from common sense. We have it in our power to begin the world over again. And it was his acceptance speech at the Republican convention. Now, keep this in mind. In that very same speech, he quotes Thomas Paine at his most Paine's always a radical, the most radical line, I would argue, in modern history. Two, he quotes Abraham Lincoln, and then he quotes Franklin Roosevelt. The conservative Republicans didn't know what to make of Reagan when he did that. George Will, can I use the S word? I'm sure George Will shit his pants, okay? Because he wrote about it. He said, what kind of conservative quotes Paine and not Burke, okay? But Reagan knew that Americans had a deep affection, even if they couldn't recount Paine's life in words, a deep affection for Paine, for Lincoln, and for FDR. And he used it in a magnificent way in his acceptance speech.
They are engaged in a project of selecting little pieces of history in order to create national myths and stories that are, you know, erroneous. But if no one's going to tell the true story, then they can get away with it, right? So you point out in your book that Glenn Beck had that, wrote a book called Glenn Beck's Common Sense that said, you know, Thomas Paine was the Glenn Beck of his time.
That book that he wrote was the most disgusting piece of shit. You know what? Glenn Beck actually laid claim to Paine and literally turned every single one of Paine's arguments inside out and upside down. There was no link between the two.
And that's why it's important to return to the original writings, because you can't lie. When you actually, if you actually open up the Age of Reason, right, you can see just how scandalous. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, it still feels, as I was reading some of the stuff he's saying, it still, you know, it still feels provocative, even here in 2021. Even now that religion has, organized religion has been on the decline for a while. I mean, he's so aggressive that. It's amazing how fresh it seems. I mean, we've dwelled upon Paine, but he's sort of a case study. I mean, Paine, as you say, is the greatest of the founding generation, and someone who obviously we need to reclaim. But it's the same as you sort of said at the beginning. In every single generation, there are figures who were doing the work and who were invoking the values that we hold, and they have all sort of disappeared from view, because if no one is telling their stories, if no one is quoting from them, if no one's telling the truth, then they become neutralized. They become, Martin Luther King is the obvious example, right, where he becomes a series of uplifting platitudes about how we all want to get along with one another, and then you lose all of the force of his anti-imperialism and his radical calls for economic democracy and his tributes to the labor movement. Frederick Douglass, I was just reading a speech that I only saw this a few months ago. I had never been introduced to this speech of Frederick Douglass's, where he's talking about labor in the post-slavery South, and he's talking about the sharecropping system, he's talking about exploitation, and he's talking about how emancipation has essentially become a joke, right? It's a sick, twisted joke because of the reality of what it means to have no capital and have all everything you earn be then taken away by your landlord, right? All of this stuff that Frederick Douglass is saying that I never knew he said, because nobody ever teaches you about it.
Well, and to come into the 20th century, how many Americans recognize the name A. Philip Randolph? Okay, who was not simply a major labor leader and a major civil rights figure, but was also a socialist, okay, undeniably a socialist, and gave a speech in the middle of the 1920s in the sesquicentennial of the American Revolution, where he says, the historians have really failed on the question of Reconstruction. How often do they point out that Reconstruction is the time in which African Americans brought democracy to the South for the first time ever? And then he says, and I love this line, I wish he were alive during the Black Lives Matter movement. He said, in this century, we will bring economic democracy to all of America. You know, I mean, it was the sense of these radical figures who knew how to speak in a way that both didn't just offer a vision and a promise, but spoke deeply to what it meant to be an American. You know, I'll give you a sidebar example of what I've been talking about. So when AOC was elected to Congress, you know, because she was a Democratic Socialist and a young woman, I don't remember if it was Anderson Cooper or somebody of his ilk interviewed her and basically asked her, you know, inspiration and what hope is, you know, does she have any hope for American progressive politics? And she cited Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt as proof of what might be possible. Two presidents who in their respective ways radically transformed America in the midst of tremendous crisis, empowered in the first instance by white workers who fought in the war and African-American slaves who made it a point of going to the Union lines such that hundreds of thousands of them would serve in the Union forces. And with FDR, the labor movement of the 1930s. And would you believe the art, you know, it comes out, the New York Times interviews a few historians and a couple of them leftists, and they all offered a little critique of her references to Lincoln and to FDR. But why the hell would you offer a critique from the left of references like that? Because of this need to debunk a little bit. It should have been the case where they said, it's great to hear an American political figure of the left lay claim to the American progressive story. I mean, that's the thing. We've just got to do those.
Well, I want to ask you about how you think about FDR, because I know that a lot of there's a sort of, I think if you bring FDR up with leftists, you typically get, well, everything FDR did, he did because he was trying to preserve capitalism, and the labor movement had to force him to do various things, and he wanted to preserve the ruling class, and you know, therefore had to make concessions. And also, the hideous human rights abuse of the internment of the Japanese, you know, really is a serious blot on his legacy. So how do you think about what is the correct story to tell about Roosevelt and the New Deal?
Okay, well, let me start out by making clear. There are three major political tragedies of FDR's decision-making. Mm-hmm. Okay. The first one, and these all have to do with going in, it comes up on the entry to the war. Okay. The first one is the internment of the Japanese Americans. Okay. That's one of the worst abuse, one of the worst, civil rights, I think somebody once called the worst civil rights, you know, abuse in American history, something like that. Okay, but it's worse. I mean, it's tragic. The second one is the fact that he did not purge the State Department in order to possibly enable more Jewish refugees to escape Hitler's Germany. Okay, but it's also the case that Congress was filled with anti-Semites who were determined not to allow it. And even Robert F. Wagner, the German-American senator from New York, could not get them to lift the immigration quotas, okay? And the third one is the fact that he set limits. He allowed the military to talk him into setting a 10% limit on the on African-Americans serving in the military and created a Jim Crow military. There's no denying that. Okay. Well, okay. And I'm not going to say, so what? What I am going to say is, first of all, this idea that the labor movement made him do it. Well, in the first 100 days, when the labor movement itself was still reeling from 1920 and the Great Depression of 1930, FDR signed into law the National Industrial Recovery Act, which, not the National Labor Relations Act, that's 35. In 33, he signed into law the NIRA, and that included collective bargaining rights for workers and the very first minimum wage in America, okay? Mm-hmm. So the fact is that he FDR empowers labor in good part by his own account to push him all the more. There's the dialectic between Roosevelt and working people is fascinating. FDR encourages and engages Americans in their labors for the New Deal, but also to empower them to organize. In 1935, FDR gave a speech and he said, "New laws in themselves do not bring the millennium." And what he meant by that is you're still going to have to fight. So I think the knee-jerk response of the left is mm-hmm. is actually just dumb. Okay. Mm-hmm. FDR was undeniably a progressive and a social democrat who made some terrible, terrible decisions along the way. But if you put together the first 100 days, the second New Deal, Social Security, and the National Labor Relations Act, the Fair Labor Standards Act, and then during the war, a whole host of it's almost like a third New Deal, you might say. And then in 1944, he calls for an economic bill of rights, knowing that Americans, because he's actually had some, you know, professors run national surveys, a massive set of surveys. He knows Americans want social democracy, and he puts it on the agenda. So I think the left has really done damage to itself, to ourselves, by not laying claim to Lincoln and FDR. I really do.
And it's other figures too. I mean, you can go through, and there's so much. When I was writing the socialism book, I mean, I wanted to talk about Helen Keller and Albert Einstein.
Oh,
and you can talk about Eleanor Roosevelt. You can talk about, you know, you go through and you mine history, and you find that, especially again when you read people's actual writings, you find so much to inspire you. So many brilliant people who struggled against the oppressive conditions of their time.
Listen to this. Here's an argument, and you can debunk it if you wish.
Okay.
Even though I'm your guest, take it on if you wish.
Okay.
Look, I thought about this after I did the Payne stuff, and then I did the FDR and Greatest Generation stuff. I am absolutely convinced that Americans are essentially radicals at heart. And the first proof is the degree to which in every single generation there has been a significant radical, or if you prefer, progressive movement that has emerged to challenge the status quo. And I mean, this is over and over and over again. And in its diversity alone, it's extremely impressive. That's first. But more important than that, in a punchline kind of way, is this. The three greatest crises in American history were in the 1770s, the 1860s, and the 1930s and 40s, a sort of dual set of crises, okay? And ask yourself, I tell my students, I'm emeritus now, but for all those many years, I would say to students, why, when asked, do Americans believe the three greatest presidents or leaders were Washington, Lincoln, and FDR? And inevitably, the answers they gave were something like, well, they led us through wars that we won. But FDR's greatness is predicated as much on the 30s as anything to do with the 40s, World War II. And what I tell them is, I said, you know what? What we don't realize is that they not only led us in the midst of crises, in order to transcend the crises, whether they had it in themselves to begin with or not, Americans, whatever their faults, failings, and, you know, everything else, actually radically transformed America in each instance. So the revolution was only won because Americans followed the spirit of Paine's common sense and created a democratic republic. Look, if you look at a lot of folks would not have lined up in the revolution if it wasn't the promise of democracy and separation of church and state. Okay, that's fundamental. And both of those are at the heart of Paine's common sense. I'm not exactly sure the North would have won the Civil War had it not been for the Emancipation Proclamation and the fact that 250,000 African Americans ended up serving in the Union ranks. And I can tell you that the New Deal would never, never have prevailed had it not been for the empowerment of labor. By the way, that labor and working people demand it. Okay? I mean, FDR was not as aggressive on the labor question as the laws he signed, in the bills he signed into law. But in those moments, it's the case that the only way America, if you like, transcends a crisis is Americans, despite everything, radically transform what they're about. And, you know, of course, later things are, you know, sometimes shoved back into place. You know, Reconstruction gives way to Bourbon regime, the Cold War and McCarthyism and everything else. But it is the case that when push comes to shove, Americans have asserted a radicalism, which, by the way, I'm going to really shock the shit out of you now, might actually be. And, you know, conservatives love to talk about American exceptionalism. And the left says, F you, there is no such thing. Da, 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 da. The exceptional part of the American story is the radical story. The unparalleled radicalism of the American story, however sad it may look today, but things are happening. I mean, they've been happening. And, you know, we got to draw inspiration and encouragement.
Well, I mean, this is what I like about your work. I think there are many leftists who, as you mentioned earlier, you know, will react with our typical cynicism, or say, Lincoln or LBJ, you know, Vietnam, horrible. But, you know, but then you go back and you say, okay, well, but to the extent that LBJ is fondly remembered, it's because of the Great Society, it's because of the civil rights and voting rights. And these are things that we need to, you know, we can take the good and we can condemn the bad. We don't have to think in binaries about the villains, you know, put everyone in the villain box. We need to go through and we need to mine the rich storehouse of history for those things that we can cobble together into a story of the country that inspires us and into a program for the future. I think what I like about your book and what I like about, I mean, this book and the previous books is, as I say, there is something that runs through all of them. I mean, your final chapter of this book is "We Are Radicals at Heart, Don't Forget It," which you know, captures what you've just been saying. And what's nice is I think that in the post-Bernie moment, the American left is somewhat adrift. People don't know what we're going to do next. People feel very hopeless, especially because of climate change. And what you give us in these various works is a way to feel, to look forward by looking backward, you know, to look at the utopians, to look at the labor organizers, to look at the civil rights movements, the socialists, you know, and to take all of it and come up and also look at the fact that they worked under conditions often much harder than we have ourselves to face. I mean, they faced the kinds of oppression that, you know, we have managed to, for the most part, eradicate. And that gives us a place to start, and it gives us a kind of leftist philosophy that I think can really fill our souls. And you've got to fill people's souls. I think when you said Reagan was clever, I think you were right. And one reason Reagan was clever is Reagan knew how to fill people's souls. And until we learn how to do that, I don't know that we're going to capture the public imagination.
One thing I haven't mentioned, I mentioned poetry earlier and that I couldn't memorize it very effectively. But there are a series of poets in American history who really do capture the American story. And in some ways, I took to having my students, before we started the course, Historical Perspectives on American Democracy, I had them read the poem by Langston Hughes, "Let America Be America." Let America be America again, the land that never was but must be. And he really does capture the struggle that has always been at the heart of the American story for all of the exploitation and all of the oppression. People should go back, they should read Douglass's "What to the Slave is the 4th of July." I used to assign it to my students and say, tell me, and you'll excuse the word I'm about to use, is Douglass an antagonist or a patriot of America? And and I always knew who read it all the way through, because it's a lengthy sermon speech that he gave in 1852. And those who came back and said he was an antagonist only read halfway through, because you can't read the last half a dozen paragraphs without realizing that Douglass, despite all of the berating of the American story that far, says, and yet there's an American promise that is so powerful that we can prevail. Okay. I mean, it's that kind of stuff that might, you know, at bedtime, read this stuff. If, you know, if you're feeling despondent, keep in mind that, you know, it was the age of slavery in which half of the United States was dominated by white supremacists who could decide on life and death for an individual.
I always feel like if Martin Luther King, days before his assassination, could say that he could see the promised land, right, and that he could keep moving forward, then who are we to lapse into cynicism, despair, and inaction? Well, Professor Harvey Kay, Thank you so much. I've wanted to talk to you for a long time because I think I really do think these books that you've written are really rich with inspiration for people, and people find out a lot of things about the past they didn't know and a lot of things about their country that they didn't know. The most recent book is Take Hold of Our History, Make America Radical Again. Professor Harvey Kay, thank you so much for joining me.
Nathan, thank you very much. I really have been looking forward to this opportunity. Thank you.
The Current Affairs Podcast is a product of Current Affairs Magazine. If you are not subscribed to Current Affairs Magazine, visit currentaffairs.org/subscribe today and get our glorious print edition. The Current Affairs Podcast is released regularly every week on patreon.com/currentaffairs. Thanks for listening.
Let America be America again. Let it be the dream it used to be. Let it be the pioneer on the plain seeking a home where he himself is free. America was never America to me. Let America be the dream the dreamers dreamed. Let it be that great, strong land of love where never kings connive nor tyrants scheme, that any man be crushed by one above. It was never America to me. Oh, let my land be a land where liberty is crowned with no false patriotic wreath, but opportunity is real and life is free, equality in the air we breathe. There's never been equality for me, nor freedom in this homeland of the free. We must take back our land again. America, oh yes. I say it plain, America was never America to me. And yet I swear this oath, America will be. Out of the rake and ruin of our gangster death, the rape and rot of graft, of stealth and lies, we, the people, must redeem the land, the mines, the plants, the rivers, the mountains, and the endless plain. All the stretch of these great green states, and make America again.